when disaster strikes. Will you be ready?
Good evening, and we begin tonight with the monster hurricane and its deadly impact already.
When all hope is gone, will the government be there for you? If you're looking for ways to take your prepping to the next level, then you've come to the right place. Broadcasting from a secure and well-prepared location, it's time for Prepping 2.0. And now, please welcome authors Glenn Tate and Shelby Gallagher.
Hello, everyone. This is Shelby Gallagher. Welcome to our latest episode of our awesome show, Prepping 2.0. What we're going to be talking about today is regional differences in prepping, specifically Minnesota and Quebec, Canada. Love to hear from those of you who have other opinions and other experiences in other parts of the country, but that's what we're going to be talking about today. Patreons, you know who you are. You are the wonderful support we have for this show, and you get a whole lot of access to let us know some other regional differences you'd like us to do in the future. But right off the bat, let me just let everyone know, if you're just now tuning in and listening to us, especially those of you listeners in Utah, Oregon, Idaho, welcome. Always welcome you. Soon, very soon, so excited, there's going to be a radio station in Colorado, which is very near and dear to my heart. If you've read my books, Shelby Gallagher, you know that a good portion of my books take place in Colorado. I should also stop for a moment and say, I have a co-host. Welcome, Glenn.
Ooh, 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 call on me. Yeah. Hello, how are you?
I'm good. How are you today?
We should let people know that we're married. And first of all, it kind of explains some of the stuff we're going to talk about. And second of all, she's all mine, guys, so stay away. All right, there we go.
There you go. So one of the things that we do on our show, and I'm slightly rushing myself a little bit because we have so many cool things to talk about today. If you go to our website at prepping2-0.com, there's a link to the top 100 things that will disappear in a collapse. And it's based upon people who have experienced and researched what happened during the collapse of Bosnia. This week's number that we're going to go talk about is number 19, very near and dear to my heart. Baby supplies. Why is that near and dear to my heart? I talk about a lot in my books. Babies need a lot of supplies, in particular baby formula, baby diapers. Those are the two biggies. Diapers mainly for the adults in their life who have to take care of them and have to deal with the human waste aspect, but baby formula. Babies need a lot of nutrition their first year, for sure, if not first 3 years of their life. And it's a very specific kind of nutrition. Baby supplies are a big deal. I encourage you to go look at that list and see if it gives you any ideas for things that you can stock up and prep for. Glenn and I here, there are no babies in our life. Human babies, I should say. And
we have some dogs, just so nobody thinks growing aliens or something
right,
like that.
Right, exactly. But we have prepped a small supply of baby formula and baby diapers for when that collapse happens, to help out the community and our neighbors and those who might be in need of that, and to barter with it, to be honest with you. So there's that. So I encourage you to look at that list. Go ahead.
Yeah, a couple thoughts on baby supplies. First of all, a lot of us preppers, and I'm going to go ahead and make some wild guesses that maybe our guests are in this category. We're not, 27 years old with babies, and we might have had kids in the past, but it's been in the distant past. And you sort of forget, you're in between having little kids and having grandkids. That's where a lot of preppers are, and that would include us. And you kind of forget how needy babies are and all the supplies that are necessary. So it's easy for preppers in our age demographic to just forget about it. So that's one of the reasons we have this show. You listen to this show, you hear, oh, geez, I never thought about baby supplies. Maybe that's something to look into. That's number one. Number two is, you mentioned community, and that's, I'm not going to cover that because you did. I would say this, barter, incredibly good barter system. I think from the political and community building up perspective, how amazingly powerful it would be with a young family, and you're able to get them some baby formula. Obviously, women can breastfeed. There's issues with that. We're not going to get it. We will not turn this show into the breastfeeding versus baby formula show, because there's plenty of debate on that. But if you can hand off some of these supplies to somebody, they're going to be an ally you know, for the duration of the collapse. It's a huge, huge important deal to them. So don't forget that. Another thing to think about with baby supplies, and this is actually your idea, Shelby, you said, hey, new moms, they get all these coupons for all this baby formula, and maybe if they don't need it or something, you can get a lot of free, and baby formula is doggone expensive if you don't get it on sale. And think about that, and diapers go on sale. Keep your eyes out for this stuff because it's one of those high markup items that when it's on sale, bam, you can really get some amazing stuff. So baby supplies, very, very critical. Shelby, you have the I Miss America moment of the week. Tell people what that is.
The I Miss America moment of the week is that moment where, and we've just started doing this. It's that moment where it's like you're reading something in the news cycle, you hear of someone's experience, and you just stop and you go, I miss America. I miss when this was not the case. I miss when you could talk about things in public without having to whisper. I miss America, and it's emotional, and it's, that's why I'm kind of struggling with how to explain it. But once I explain this week's I Miss America moment of the week, you'll get it. So those, Glenn and I, we live in Washington State. One of the great patriots on our side in our state legislature is Representative Matt Shea. And he recently had the left has come down, his opponents, his political opponents, and his ideological opponents, more importantly, have always targeted him. Because if you follow him, I encourage you to go find him on Facebook and follow him. He stands for gun rights. He stands for religious freedom. He stands for the Constitution. He's a constitutional lawyer. He is one of the good guys. And the left has always targeted him. Well, what happened just recently is The Guardian, a big, huge left-leaning newspaper, came out and got a hold of some information how Matt Shea is looking to do surveillance on his opponents to incite violence, to harm them. First of all, let me just say this. This is the I Miss America aspect of this. If you are in politics, and Glenn and I have our own experiences in the circles and hallowed halls of politics, you always do oppositional research on your opponent. You need to know who they are, where they come from, who they represent, who funds them. That is politics, ladies and gentlemen. So for anyone to say Matt Shea is doing something, anything, tell you what, I have had the left show up at my door when I've had political opponents. I've had them sit in front of my house.
True story. This is not made up. Yes.
So for the left to accuse Matt of doing something like that, when you have someone sitting out in front of your house with a camera looking at your house that has your children in it, you tell me if you don't feel threatened. So anyway, so Matt Shea basically had a conversation saying, yeah, I want to know who these people are. And I want to do surveillance on them. Why? Because they are his opponents, and they have also threatened him. Matt Shea gets death threats pretty frequently. So because it's the Guardian, they come out and make it sound like Matt is the instigator of violence because he wants to know who his opponents are and what they're up to. So that's the I Miss America moment of the week. Had this happened years and years ago, honestly, it would have been like, yeah, it would have been a non-issue. You just know who your opponents are in the political world. Folks, I'm going to tell you right now. Everyone knows if you are running for an office of any kind, if you don't know who your opponents are and who's funding them and what they are up to, you're not doing it right. Glenn, jump in.
Yeah, and this is that organized political violence thing that we talk about as a first step in what we hope doesn't happen, a civil war. And so this is an example of that. And it just this week, it really hit us because we know Matt, he's a friend of ours. And to see him go through this. And by the way, the death threats are extremely detailed. And one of them, I'm told, was actually death threat was made by somebody who is in prison, triple homicide, I want to say. So these are not like you're a poopy head kind of death threats. These are real things. And so this didn't used to happen in America. And this is the coarsening, the nastiness, and all of that other stuff. And this is why it's an I Miss America moment.
And it's not just threats against him, because Matt's a warrior. I mean, he is. He can take the brunt of this. It's against his family and family members. And to the point where it's one thing if you're the target, I get that. If someone's going to come out, here's the example. Someone comes after me and wants to throw a punch at me. Okay, you go after my kids, game's on. You know what I mean? The flares go up even higher and the defenses go up when you start attacking someone's family and sending those kind of threats. So our thoughts and prayers are with Matt and his family. We love him. We love what he stands for. And I miss America.
Exactly. And I would like to be a little bit more positive and upbeat. And that is the cool spouse of the week. People order stuff from us, I Miss America themed things, which that's the connection between I Miss America. That phrase was in my books, 299 Days, really taken off. In the books, it's something that the Patriots spray paint because it just communicates volumes about stuff that we all feel. And anyway, the cool spouse of the week is Brett in Florida. He and his wife ride Harleys, I assume Harleys, I don't know, hogs, and they're probably not little Kawasaki dirt bikes. I'm just going to go ahead and say that. And he got for his wife a Hoorag. And what Hoorags are is kind of a weird name. It's this thing. It can do 9 different things. It can be a head wrap and a neck wrap and blah, blah, blah. But it's used primarily for, it covers your face and it says, I miss America. And it covers your face. So when you're riding a motorcycle, the wind, you know, isn't as snappy as it otherwise would be. And they look really cool. You see pictures of me and Shelby in our I Miss America Hoorag. So I thought that was just cool. I thought that was a really thoughtful thing. And I can just see Brett and his wife riding around in Florida. And that just seems like a cool, happy thing. Well, this is a segue into a feature that we call What's in the Merch Shack.
What's in the Merch Shack this week? Cool things that we have coming up in the Merch Shack. First of all, many of you have asked me and sent me emails and sent me messages, when are you going to update your sizes of t-shirts and hoodies? I'm working on that right now. We're working on getting a new vendor. But what's in the Merch Shack this week, I would say cool thing. I'm gonna piggyback on last week because they've been so popular. I want people to know that we are close to running out and we want to get more, is the 30-round AR mags that are so cool with the I Miss America logo on the bottom so that when you're at the range, you've got your flash and your little I Miss America and you look really cool.
And it starts awesome conversations.
Yes, it does. Oh, awesome. My gosh. Just wearing the t-shirts when we go walk around. What does that mean? People walk up just and ask, what does it mean? And it's really easy. What does it mean to you? And 99% of the time, I miss what it used to be like. But when I was a kid, I miss opportunities that my kids had when I was a kid, all those things. And they're heartfelt conversations. So recommend our merch stuff.
That's right. And it's 299days.com, the shop tab, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's all cool. But what's really cool is our guests.
Absolutely. And you can hear them in the background chuckling with all of our humor, which makes me feel good that we're funny.
We came up with this a while ago. Actually, a listener from Cincinnati was at one of the expos we did in Idaho, and he said, you should do something about the regional differences in prepping, because he and I started talking about what's different about prepping in Cincinnati. He couldn't make this call, and he's going to be a guest on another show, because we're going to do more of these regional differences shows, because this is fascinating. We try really hard not to be sort of Washington State-centric, and it's what we know, but obviously, people are all over the place. And whenever I talk to people about the regional differences that they have, I learn a lot about where they are, and it's fascinating. But you also can take the information about their situation and apply it to where you are, maybe not directly, but you can start to see things a little differently. So today is the Northern Exposure episode, which is Minnesota and Quebec. And Rick is in Minnesota, and so we thought we would ask you, Rick, why don't you just tell folks about yourself and your prepping situation?
Alrighty, glad to be on the show here. First of all, where I live in Minnesota, if you would take and draw a line from Duluth, Minnesota to Fargo, North Dakota, put your finger in the middle, you're in the kind of general area where I live, so you can see how far north I am. And so part of the thing that plays into the prepping is the weather. Our last frost date is around Memorial Day weekend, and then the frost will come again sometime in the fall, depending on what Mother Nature decides to throw at us up here. So that's part of the challenge. And rain can be a challenge. We've had summers where it's nice and wet for the garden, be growing and everything. And then August, Mother Nature turns the spigot off. And then I've got to go to watering the garden somewhat by hand and somewhat with the drip irrigation systems that I have in there. So a lot of challenges there. But, you know, where I live in Minnesota, you know, the land of 10,000 plus lakes, there's a lot of water around. But getting it from one location to another would be a bit of a challenge. And so I like, you know, gardening. I have raised chickens in the past, haven't for the last few years. I've had bees, but now the price of a box of bees has gone up to $180, so they're off there. But I've got friends that do that type of stuff, and also one of a local company that's heavily into resilience and teaching people how to be resilient in their lifestyle. They've fired up a CSA, and as part of that CSA, they're raising chickens. So I ordered a bunch of chickens through them, and then a guy I've worked with in the past at the phone company here is raises cattle, and so hopefully I'm going to get a quarter of beef from him. So we get a lot of locally produced food and meat that I can get my hands on relatively easy. So.
Well, and what's a CSA? I know, but some other folks may not know. It's a cool thing.
Yeah, community supported agriculture, and the business that they have up there. They've got a large area in front of the building there that's open, and they got a large garden there and greenhouses that, and so that's something new they've started up this year. You can either buy a half share or a full share, and so it's going to definitely benefit a lot of people in the area.
And that's basically where you pay into the CSA, and they have a big farm, and then, or farms plural, and then if they have carrots, I'm making all this up, I'm probably butchering the growing season, so they have carrots in March, then you get some carrots, and if they have plums in August, you get plums, and it's a great way to be part of the farm but not have to own your own farm. It's a really clever thing. It's a template. It's a conceptual kernel of a model for what I see happening after the collapse and things stabilizing. I think that sort of thing where people, if they have money to contribute or supplies, but they don't have the skills or the experience or the farmland or the machinery, they can help the enterprise, and then the enterprise ends up helping them. So I'm a big fan of CSAs. Well, what are some of the benefits? I think you hit on it a little bit. What are some of the benefits about prepping in Minnesota? Because you're describing some hardy, resilient, community-focused people, which I think is far more important than having 99 AR-15s or something like that. What are some benefits about where you are?
Well, part of the benefit is semi-rural, even though where I live it's probably the prime vacation area in the state. So once opening of fishing starts here in a couple of weeks and on through the summer, population goes way up. But once school starts again in the fall, the population goes way down. And having been in this area for pretty much my entire life, you know a lot of people. And what's interesting is that most everyone around here is quite conservative. If you ever look at a map of how people vote in Minnesota, you've got the liberals in the Twin Cities and the liberals union people in Duluth North on the Iron Range that vote, typically Democratic. But a lot of the rest of the state, where I'm at, people tend to vote Republican. And so people having guns and hunting and all of that fun stuff is normal up here. And it's pretty tight-knit also. I know people on other programs have talked about when you move into an area that you've not lived in before, and it can take a while to get into being a part of the community. And it's a little bit like that up here, except with so many visitors, not quite as tight-knit as you might find in other areas. But again, very supportive of gun rights and being self-resilient up here. People, whether it's growing gardens or raising chickens and things like that, it's really common. I got a really quick, funny story. When I started getting into raising chickens, my wife thought I was nuts. Well, that happens. And
it does. Yeah. Sometimes you need to get a second one, but go ahead.
But the well, no. But anyway,
that was cruel. That was terrible. I apologize.
Well, we've been married for almost 43 years. So, but okay. Anyway,
congratulations.
Well, thank you. But anyway, you know, thinking I was nuts for getting chickens, she would, you know, be chatting with her friends at work and come to find out that, gee, number of people have either had chickens or currently have chickens. So my being nuts score dropped significantly. So and that, but. And that was a fun adventure in that. And but it's you know, and it's also a really good place to raise kids, you know, because it's kind of generally conservative. You know, I read stories about what's being put on in public schools in California, other places, and shake my head because I know it would never happen up here in that. So it's a really good area just to live in, even though the winters are something people generally like to avoid.
Well, and that's a question about the winters. Do you think that the long winters where you may not have access to, you know, just-in-time inventory stuff, the roads could be snowed in? It's just, it's weird, isn't it, what freezes at 40 below zero? Stuff you didn't even think had liquid in it all of a sudden is ice. But do you think that that has created a culture or a mindset about people generally being a little bit more resilient?
I think so. You know, this last winter has been a long, hard winter, but it kind of reminded me of in the 60s, we would have winters about like this. And so anyone, you know, in their 40s or younger was an entirely new experience. It was also an interesting experience because that polar vortex that came blasting through back in January, the temperature did dip to 40 below. And because I knew because I was out driving around and it was 40 below. But what some of the propane companies found out is that propane can freeze at 40 below. But fortunately, my tank had like 2 feet of snow on it and a lot of other snow around, so nothing froze. And as far as the roads, it could affect, especially if it would get icy. But the road, you know, whether it's a county or the state, we're used to this stuff, and they get out and get the roads cleared off in pretty short order. But still, when the last couple big storms came through here, you go to the grocery store, and people are not running to the grocery store and stocking up on everything under the sun. So there is that idea that you sometimes just need to take care of yourself. Plus, it's sometimes not a short trip to get to the grocery store. For me, it's closest one, it's somewhat convenient store. Otherwise, it's 6 miles or 20 miles to get to a big grocery store. So people, I think, large part tend to have a pretty well-stocked pantry. And we don't freak out, supposed to get 10 inches of snow, for example.
Well, and we have a minute. Here's a question for you. Is prepping as a thing, in other words, formally saying, yes, I'm a prepper, is that a weird thing where you are, or is it kind of accepted, or is it not an issue because everybody just lives that way and they don't need a label? They don't need someone to tell them they're a prepper because they have, you know, supplies on hand. And we have about 30 seconds.
I don't know if how prevalent it is, but a lot of people hunt, and then they preserve what they, shoot, and they also grow gardens and preserve what they have. So it's nothing really odd or ordinary to, be able to take care of yourself for a while.
Awesome. So we're going to take it to the break. Join us on the other side as we talk with Rick and Bruce about regional differences in prepping.
We'll be right back with more of Prepping 2.0 with authors Shelby Gallagher and Glenn Tate right after this.
The Operator G1 is a full-featured, rugged comm solution designed for the Midland MX-T100 and 105. Designed and manufactured in the USA, the Operator is an all-in-one support platform for two-way wireless communication for civilians. Using the GMRS bands, there is no ham license required and no test needed for operation. Ideal for preppers, hunters, homesteaders, ranchers, and people just like you. Waterproof when closed, this rugged system houses the Midland radio, microphone, and antenna, providing an always-ready, always-charged grab-and-go solution for emergencies or events, as well as an ideal solution for a base station or vehicle use. Powered by a 60 Ah internal battery, the Operator recharges quickly and easily using the supply supplied AC charger, the internal solar controller, or directly from a vehicle. If you recognize the value of wireless communication with or without grid power, the Operator G1 is an award-winning solution that allows simple, one-button communication when it counts. Our 2-year warranty, quality materials, and first-class assembly technicians deliver a high-value solution when you need to be sure you can get your comms up. To learn more, go online to PortableUniversalPower.com.
Do you need a custom Kydex holster or magazine holder? Glenn Tate's favorite custom holster and mag holder maker is Northwest Retention Systems. You can select your holster or mag holder color, including the I Miss America logo, and Northwest Retention Systems will custom make yours. While you're at it, look into the Scout Chest Rig Holster. Glenn loves his for vehicle operations and for fishing. Made by a young craftsman supporting a growing family of young patriots, Northwest Retention Systems products are 100% American-made with no foreign parts. Find out more online at NorthwestRetentionSystems.com.
PrepperNet, where preppers unite. Looking to meet other like-minded people in your area? Looking to start your own prepper group? Already have a group? Join PrepperNet.com. PrepperNet has gathered the biggest names in the industry to help unite preppers everywhere. Join John Jacob Schmidt, Scott Hunt, Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy, Glenn Tate, Shelby Gallagher, Charlie Hogwood, Samuel Culper, Survivor Jane, Rick Austin, Franklin Horton, Ryan Mitchell, and Brian Duff. Our team is united. Check us out at PrepperNet.com. PrepperNet, where preppers unite. PrepperNet.com.
And we're back with more of Prepping 2.0 with authors Glenn Tate and Shelby Gallagher.
Welcome back, everyone. Shelby Gallagher here. So excited to talk to our guest today. Continuing the conversation, we've just talked to Rick, who lives in Minnesota, talking about some of the regional differences that people have around our continent. And you'll find out why I'm using that word in a moment, regarding prepping. And the other guest that we have who's been kind of listening in the background here is Bruce, who lives in Quebec. Welcome, Bruce.
Hi. How are you guys?
Very good. Now, I'm going to ask you to tell a little bit about yourself. And part of that explanation, Bruce, is why you have the accent you do and why you live where you live. So tell us about yourself, Bruce.
I'm originally a New Zealander. I've been living in Quebec, Canada for over 30 years now. So that's where the accent comes from, although it's a little mixed up with some Canadian and a little bit of Canadian French as well, too. So that's where the accent comes from.
Very good. So how did you become a prepper? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
That's kind of a long story, but I guess growing up in New Zealand, it's always been a self-reliant country. So things were always like, well, you just can't send away for that because it'll take 6 months on the boat there, 6 months on the boat to get back. So figure it out for yourself. So I think that's had a lot to do with the way I grew up. And then I moved to Canada. I've been remarried, and we're... Both my wife and myself are into prepping. We live on the island of Montreal, which is unfortunate as it's a very liberalistic city, and I think it's a lot like Seattle and their liberal views and things. So we eventually ended up buying a piece of rural property outside Montreal and just outside the province of Quebec and Ontario, and that's where we spend most of our time now, although we do bounce backwards and forwards between the city and the rural property.
Very good. So what I want to do, and because I know you listened to a recent episode that we had where we talked to the owner of Strategic Landscape and Design, Brian Domke, about kind of the four aspects of how to design your property to work for you as a prepper. So what I'd like to, and I know you really enjoyed that episode, we talked about that offline, love to know what you do specifically, Bruce, in your situation regarding water, food, alternative energy, and security. And I'm going to let you kind of go up and down that kind of chart, that outline, and talk to us about prepping from in Canada, keeping in mind that there's different political landscape and very different weather. So
Different language, yeah, too. I mean, in Quebec, they speak French.
Franglais.
Love it. This is your chance to kind of talk to us as Americans. What's the difference, and what can we do to learn from you? Yeah, go for it.
Well, I think the biggest thing that we have is the gun laws. They're tremendously different between Canada and the United States, and then within each province too. And Quebec has probably got the strictest gun laws out there. You know, we have weapons are classified as standard weapons, then restricted, then prohibited. So I won't go into it because it's long and boring, but something like an AR is considered a restricted weapon up here. You have to have a special permit. You can't use it for hunting. You can only take it between your residence and the range. You have limited capacity magazines. It's tremendously difficult. The same applies for handgun. A handgun here is a restricted weapon, and you're only allowed to use it at the range that you belong to and transport it backwards and forwards to your home. That's sort of a quick overcap of the weapons. It's a long story, and it gets very nasty, and of course it's all political as well too.
So. Of course. So let me just jump in here. For those of us in America who fight hard for Second Amendment rights, you just heard where we can end up. You can only use your firearms at a range and for nothing else if we allow the political landscape to continue on the current path. Be inspired. Keep fighting good fight. Keep going, Bruce. Love to hear more from you.
Okay. As I said, we have a residence on the island of Montreal, but we've decided to bulk up our preppings, and we bought a rural property, which we spend a lot of our time at, and we're in the process of trying to move there full time. It's about 45 minutes to an hour outside Montreal. It's a block of about 50 acres. We have some pine trees on it. We have open land, an old barn, which we're in the process of trying to restore. Going through the four tenants, I guess the first one, water is, we are on a well, and it's electrically operated, so a generator is on the list. The generator panel is already installed. My wife is an amazing gardener. She has a great green thumb, and over the last 2 years we've put in a raised bed garden. We put in some of the hay bale gardens, and we spent a lot of time and energy improving the soil. But as Rick did mention, it's cold up this way, and we have a limited growing season. So it's one of these things, we get out there as quickly as we can. And typically the last frost here is not until around May 20th, 24th, around the, it occurs, it coincides with the Victoria Day weekend, as we call it here in Canada, which is a national holiday. So typically everyone's out planting that weekend. So that's when we try and get as much as we can into the ground. As I said, my better half is wonderful, great green thumb, and I've learned a lot from her. We put out as much as we can. We've had squash, we've had peas, peppers, tomatoes, all of that stuff, and teaching ourselves canning as well, and that's really been interesting in the last few years. That's food. What else did we have there? There was water, food,
alternative energy.
Yeah, that's a little challenging here. We're looking into solar panels, and we're looking into the wind energy as well. We're lucky enough to be far enough away from the city that pretty much they leave us alone here. If you go and do something, then you don't have to worry about the homeowners association, or you don't have to worry about any of the local city showing up and saying, where's the permit? They pretty much leave us alone. So we're in good shape on that. But definitely we're heading into the PV panels and to the wind as well. That's next on the schedule. So.
Well, okay, good. Well, thank you. And I'm going to jump back, because one of the other things, and this is where I was hoping we could spend at least some time, because I think the last one on that list is security.
Yeah.
And we just talked about how your security and your ability to secure is thwarted a little bit by the restrictive gun laws. So what are your options? And this could apply to someone who, you know, here in the United States, who lives in an apartment in Seattle, or, you know what I mean? When you're in a place that's fairly restricted or a gun-free zone, what are your alternatives? Love to hear your ideas and your thoughts.
You know what? That is a very good question. That is a very good question. It's a very difficult question to answer, because there's been many cases here in Canada of people using a firearm, and the first thing that the police do when they show up is arrest you for using a firearm. And it's a tough situation. We don't have the castle doctrine as you do in many states up here. It's pretty tough. You know, there are ways around it, but it's an extremely hard thing to do if you pick up a firearm and use it at somebody that's coming at you on your property.
So let me just clarify for those who are listening who may not know what the Castle Doctrine is. It's one of these really cool things it's one of those rights we as Americans can easily forget that we even have. It's if, I don't know of any jurisdiction or municipality that doesn't allow some sort of version of this, but basically someone comes into your home, onto your property to do you harm of some kind, especially murderous, assaultive sort of harm, and you defend yourself with the fire. You defend your castle. That's where that we get the terminology. And so you have the right, it's the right to self-defense and the right to use firearms to do that. Time and time again, and we see it all the time in the Second Amendment world, where almost daily here in the United States, someone has defended their castle using a firearm because a home invasion, some sort of attack, some sort of crazed person comes to their door. They don't have that in Canada. So here's what you've just described to me, Bruce. Someone comes pounding on your door, knocking down your door, and they are ready to do you harm, murderous harm, assaultive, homicidal sort of harm, and you can't defend yourself. You do not have the ability legally to defend yourself with equal amount of violence. Right? If somebody comes to your door with an illegal firearm to shoot you, you cannot use your legal firearm to shoot back. That's sad.
That is essentially really, really what will happen is, nine times out of 10, what will happen if you do turn around and shoot back, as I said, they will show up, they will seize your firearms, they will take you to jail, and you just have a long, expensive legal bill to sort it out. So it's you may get off eventually, but it's going to cost you a tremendous amount of money, stress, and it could even cost you your family. And because you're being investigated, you will lose your firearms license. Any criminality, anything, they're constantly checking on you all the time for firearms up here. So if you have a license and you have any felonies, you have any criminal or anything like that, your firearms license will be revoked in a blink of an eye.
So what I'm hearing you say is, okay, once you register your firearm, they use that list as a registry to monitor you and surveil you.
It's your actual license. It's not your firearms. It's actually you have to go for a firearms license here. We call it a PAL. It's called a PAL.
It's essentially a registry. In other words, a registration so that they can keep track of you and surveil you, which is exactly what those of us in the Second Amendment communities do not. I don't want my name on a list somewhere so that I can then be targeted by government. Poor Glenn over here, he's the attorney here. Do you want to jump in and say anything?
No, you guys are doing a great job. I'm going to hit the mute button and listen.
Very good. So now that we've just kind of gotten all bummed out about that, Bruce, what are your alternatives if you cannot use a firearm to defend yourself? Because it could happen here. I know you're laughing. Are we doing swords or machetes this week? I mean, what
baseball
are you?
Bets.
Right, exactly.
Baseball bets.
And I'll say that before I got into firearms, and especially with kids in the house and that sort of thing, yeah. I had a steel baseball bat in almost in every room. So that if somebody came through that door and I knew how to swing up and take them in the chin, I mean, is it all ideal? No, but it's at least something. So, I mean, what are your – really? Is that what you're using, baseball bats these days?
Whatever's at hand, I think. And, it's funny enough that we heard people – even mace up here is completely illegal, but it's legal to have a can of bear spray that's 15 times the size of a small can of mace. So, having a can of bear spray by the door can certainly help. So, not that I would actually tell people to do that. But it's been known to happen.
Wow.
Well, here's a question for you, Bruce. Given that there are virtually no guns, and I know you can have single-shot shotguns, and that's probably on the standard list and those sorts of things. So there are firearms. I don't want to exaggerate.
There's plenty of firearms out there, especially in the rural areas that we are. It's not uncommon to be outside in the day and hear gunshots. So there's plenty of firearms around. There's a lot of firearms in Canada.
Oh, okay. And that's good. And I also understand, I don't want to get into the details of it, but I've always been fascinated by this. I'm told that an M1A is not, it's a restricted, but it's not a prohibited firearm. It's somehow easier to have the very awesome M1A, but all of a sudden, if it's an AR-15, it's a big, spooky, evil, nasty thing.
That's exactly it.
Oh, man, because I'm telling you what, M1A is a fantastic weapon. So good on you.
We get the Chinese knockoffs, the M305s up here, which are not restricted, and they're basically the old M1 equipment that was sold to China, and they're building the M1s. They call it an M305 Chinese. They're available in 308, and they're also available in 7.62x39. So the AK is completely prohibited up here. Anything that looks like an AK, anything that's built on the same action as an AK, is completely prohibited.
But the Chinese making knockoff M1A is A-OK.
Is A-OK.
That is fabulous. So good on you. So it's not as dire. I had a client, actually, a Canadian client, and he was a gun guy, and we had this long conversation. It's still bleak and bad, and don't get me wrong.
Yes, it's bad.
But I was impressed with some of the Canadian ingenuity on some of the workarounds. So you got that going. But my question is somewhat related to firearms, and that is people, because that's why you have firearms, that and, of course, criminals, predator, like, you know, bear and stuff like that. But are people, say, in your bug out location, because forget Montreal, because that's a city, are they hardy? Are they community focused but not socialist? I mean, you heard Rick describe what I think is a pretty good setup in Minnesota. Yeah. I mean, as far as the human terrain goes, what's the human terrain like 45 minutes outside of Montreal?
It's really interesting because it's Eastern Ontario, so the language is French and English, but they have a very different view of the socialistic Quebec thing. They're not focused on that. The general terrain around the area that we're in, we have some great friends around this area. They're a little bit liberalistic, but they're used to being by their own. They're used to looking after themselves, because 1998, we had a serious ice storm that rolled through the whole area, and some people were without power for like 3 weeks. It knocked out a tremendous amount of power pylons. It did a tremendous amount of damage in southern Quebec and eastern Ontario. So most people are relatively self-sufficient, but they wouldn't call themselves preppers, and they would be a little bit more liberalistic than most preppers that I would know.
And how do you think the political climate of Canada, nationalized medicine and those sorts of things, do you think people in general, and we're talking about giant generalizations, which apparently is like a terrible thing, but sometimes when you're trying to have a conversation about the general habits of 10 million people, you kind of have to generalize, right? Mm-hmm. But do you think people in general, where you are, you mentioned they're pretty resilient and independent. Mm-hmm. Do they just think of the government as providing solutions or not, or somewhere in between? Because I could see if your whole life the government is doing many things for you that it doesn't do in the U.S. And by the way, the U.S. has way too much government interference in healthcare. So I'm not saying, ooh, look at icky Canada. They have the government involved in healthcare. Luckily, we don't here in the U.S. I don't mean to make it like that stark false contrast. So the role of government in the lives of Canadians, how does that affect how they might react when there's no stuff and maybe Bruce has some stuff? I mean, what you see what I'm getting at. Yeah, tell me about that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It, you know, as you said, I wouldn't worry about the city. Montreal will be, I can imagine, will probably be like Seattle. 3 days after the truck stopped rolling, it's an island. And the people there are just – it's staggering to see how entitled they feel that the government will provide everything. As you said, healthcare, everything is just provided. But they pay accordingly in their taxes. So having moved out of the city and you look around the people here, I think they're probably halfway in between. There is a certain level of entitlement because we do pay for it in our taxes. So we want something back. But on the other hand, you don't see many people that will be completely against the government. It's generally speaking, most of it seems to be middle road.
Okay, well, that's good to know. And that's going to have a big impact. Middle road I'll take, by the way. You know, I'm not a perfectionist. And that's going to have a big impact when people – you expect, I'm guessing – people to move out from Montreal and elsewhere sort of into the country? Or do you think they would be so, paralyzed with inaction that they would just sit there and they really think like the government's going to show up? Because there's two schools of thought on whether people will move out of the cities. Mm. It's going to vary regionally and culturally, of course. But, you know, what do you think about that? Do you expect people to be coming to you from Montreal?
Yes. The short answer is yes. I like the way you phrased it because, you know, as Rick mentioned too, we have real cold weather up here now. If it hits the fan in the freezing cold weather and we're having ice storms or we've got minus 35 degrees, you're not going to get anybody moving outside the city. They're all going to be staying huddled looking to try and get the government to turn the power back on or going into panic mode. They won't be moving around, but we will see people transiting outside the city, because I think there's still a few people that have got a few brain cells left in the city, but they will get out as quickly as they can, because Montreal will be like one of these other major cities. It will deteriorate very, very quickly. And as I said before, it's an island, so there's limited access in and out of the city. So yeah, it'll be tough, and they will head out.
Wow. I'm just sitting here picturing that. That's crazy. Yeah. It makes it grow exponentially. The idea of a collapse happening on a city on an island.
Yeah.
In a country of entitled people. And that is no disrespect to the Canadian people, but it is a fact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because they're even more entitled. Yeah. And imagine if it's minus 40 degrees outside.
That'd make a good book.
So we have a couple minutes, but let me jump over and ask Rick really quick. In your rural community, and you talked about how close you are to a city, Rick, same question to you. Let me pose that question to you. What's going to happen when a collapse happens? And you kind of just had a little test run of that with your extreme temperatures. And that kind of changes it. When there's extreme temperatures and people aren't moving, that's one scenario. But if there's a collapse in a situation where people can be mobile, are they going to come fleeing to the rural communities where you live, do you think? What do you think?
I think it depends on the collapse. If it's a grid down situation, I don't see people getting out of the Twin Cities area, because by the time it gets bad enough, they're not going to be able to get gas to go anywhere. And then the other thing is, where do they go from there? They can start coming up this way. There's another good-sized city in between. But I'm not one that really subscribes, the whole hungry hordes coming north. They couldn't walk up here, especially during the winter. One odd thing you mentioned, when it's really cold, we get out and move around. Like I said, when it was 40 below out here, I was off going somewhere in the morning. I don't remember where. But it's only when we get, 8, 10, 12 inches of snow that things come to a halt for a day or two. But then people are out and going around. And, of course, all the people have snowmobiles. They are out and about and having a great old time. And so the state is set up, to get this stuff taken care of. Again, unless it's ice is involved, then things really do tend to grind to a halt, or like they had in southern Minnesota when the big storm came through, they had a lot of wind. So they shut down interstates and other roads because it simply were impassable until the winds died down and they could get the plows out to get things taken care of. But I guess, I don't see people being able to get very far out of the Twin Cities, and there's a lot of the state to go to besides up where I am at.
Nice.
Well, we have about 4 minutes. How about, Rick, what's one thing you would change about prepping in Minnesota? One thing you'd change about your system, not like a new piece of gear, but what's one thing that preppers in your area would wish for? And then I'll ask the same question of Bruce later.
I think probably to be more in contact with each other. I'm part of a small group. We're all affiliated with the Catholic Church up here, and that. And I know there's a lot of people out there that are, out hunting and fishing and gardening and things like that. But there's not a real, big community focus on that. That I think would help people, especially. When things do go really bad, being able to reach out and help the people that are in need, that's something that weighs on me. But again, I think just people becoming more aware of it and having some way to get to know each other on a casual but safe basis.
Sounds like PrepperNet is for you guys.
Yes.
Bruce, what's something that you wish were different? One thing, and we have about 2 minutes.
I think probably what Rick said, it's even worse up here. It's something you don't talk about to anybody. You don't know them extremely well. You're a prepper. It's just not spoken about up here. They think you're a Martian and you've got something right on the side of your head. It would be a lot easier to communicate with a lot more people that are similar to us. And I think maybe you're right. Maybe PrepperNet's the right way to go for us.
You could be the first Canadian outpost of PrepperNet, perhaps. Well, we have about 2 minutes. I want to thank you guys for coming on. First of all, thank you guys for being Patreons. And second of all, this is the kind of interaction with Patreon supporters that is invaluable. And we're going to have more and more Patreons on for the Regional Differences shows. And it's very much appreciated. I hope you guys, you know, in the northern climes, don't feel that we only talk about Washington. We're making a concerted effort. Plus, it's just really, really interesting. I've learned so much, and people in, you know, have learned about M1As in Canada. Shelby, what are some of your thoughts for going out?
Well, and I wanted to say, again, thank you to both of you, because it is. It's good to know what happens in other regions of our continent in this situation. But you and I spoke about it offline. We've had a lot of guests from other parts of the country. We've had Kaz. We've had Brushbeater. We've had Sean Swanson. These are all people that brought to the program different aspects of what's going on in our country, which is our country and our continent. And it's great to know this, because – and the one thing I'm hearing – very consistently is the cities will suffer in a collapse grid down situation. They will suffer. And when the suffering is bad enough, they're going to cast out in one way or the other. And there's all, again, weather conditions and all that will play a part in that. And how rural you are will affect how quickly they come to your door. But that goes back to Brian Domke when you spoke to him. Have your security in place and be ready. And that's the common thread that I've heard through all of our guests. And I want to thank both Rick and Bruce for joining us today. And any last thoughts before I give my final words?
I think Rick and Bruce were spot on. It's all about community, all about networks, and that is the more important thing than stuff.
Absolutely. So the line that I always have to rush to say before we leave, I'm not going to today, it's awesome, from Benjamin Franklin, failing to prepare is preparing to fail. Have a great week, everyone.
You've been listening to Prepping 2.0 with authors Shelby Gallagher and Glenn Tate. All of the fun and easy prepping information heard on this podcast can be found online at prepping2-0.com. You can also find out more about Glenn's books online at 299days.com and about Shelby's books online at agreatstate.com. Until next time, be smart, be safe, and be prepared.